The college had outgrown its temporary quarters, and it was clearly time for a move to a new campus. Edward Shepin recalled that. We had great struggles and long debates about location. Some trustees wanted to move to New Brunswick, but Princeton was reputed to be protected from New Jersey's notorious mosquitoes and was a natural stopping point between New York and Philadelphia. From Amboy Bay, the Trenton Road arced 28 miles to Princeton, past the ash swamp near Metuchen, past the Widow Martin's Tavern, De Paister's House and Mill on the Raritan River, past the farms of low Dutch personages and a Dutch church. After a six-mile stretch of white oaks, maples, chestnuts, came John Manley's Tavern, then a string of 16 farms and a meeting house, which indicated that the traveler was nearing Princeton. It was even then an attractive town. Most of the houses are built of wood and are contiguous, so that there are gardens and pastures between them, wrote a 1749 visitor. Brainerd had spent his three best months working with Indians near there, reporting them attentive, orderly, and well-disposed. By 1756, the town already had some elegant houses. The most imposing was owned by Richard Stockton on a 500-acre tract he had purchased from William Penn. The lovely house he built in 1701 had only shortly before been given the name Morven. The elegant ladies in 1755 were all reading the poems of Ossian, in which there was an account of an ancient king, Fingal, of Caledonia, Scotland. This collection of epic poems probably was a literary hoax, but Annis Beaudenault Stockton loved them and named her house after Fingal's castle, Morven. Still a marvelous example of early American architecture, is now the residence of the governor of New Jersey. Robert Smith, who was the inspired builder of Philadelphia's Carpenter's Hall and St. Peter's Church, designed the new structure at Princeton. Burr wanted to name it after Governor Jonathan Belcher, who had been the king's representative in the state since 1747. Belcher's interest in the college was much more than official. He had presided over the meeting that elected Burr the president and had become Burr warm friend and supporter. Esther and her husband often visited the governor's mansion in Elizabethtown, and Belcher once wrote to Burr, "You cannot be more thoughtful and solicitous for the growth and prosperity of my adopted daughter and our future alma mater than I am." However, when Burr suggested to Belcher that his name go on the building, Belcher declined with the graceful retort that he aspired to be useful rather than conspicuous. The line is still used by one of the college's venerable social clubs as its motto. Instead, Belcher suggested naming the building for William III of the House of Nassau, who had delivered the British nation from those two monstrous furies, popery and slavery. Belcher may have been a gracious gentleman, but he was not ecumenical. Building Nassau Hall was as frustrating as such projects traditionally are, and it cost more than estimated. Burr wrote to a British donor, "The building proves more expensive than we first imagined from the best computations we could get. The plan was to use the beautiful, mellow-hued native stone that is a characteristic of Pennsylvania houses, but Burr fretted about getting the stone and wrote to Henry Cowell, a member of the building committee, 'Let me know if you think I had best bring a man with me to Princeton that understands quarrying.'" The carpenters poked along, Burr hovering anxiously over them. Finally, on the last possible day before snow fell and the winter term began, they moved in. Carpenters were still hammering on the unfinished basement. Burr had been determined to do everything in the plainest and cheapest manner, consistent with decency and convenience. Using that criteria, he and Robert Smith managed to produce a building that has been considered one of the architectural gems of America. NASA Hall was supposed to house 100 people, students and tutors stirred together. Behind it were two wells, an outhouse, a shed for a fire engine with leather buckets. On the east was a kitchen and the steward's quarters. A row of little buttonwood trees had just been planted nearby, but otherwise the scene was bald and raw when the students moved in. Esther, meanwhile, was delightedly settling into the house Burr had built for her next door, largely from his own funds. When the trustees tried to lure John Witherspoon to be their president in 1766, they dangled that house as bait. A large, handsome, and commodious dwelling house is provided for the use of the president, together with a good garden and sufficient quantity of land to furnish him winter fuel and pasturage. Still inhabited by the dean of the college today, the house Burr built for Esther was airy and attractive, with a nobly proportioned front hall. Along its wall, there is still a long bench where students once sat while they were waiting to see Burr. There were two splendid living rooms, on a scale appropriate for the large amount of entertaining Esther pitched in to do, after the manner of her mother. In a darkish back parlor, Burr conducted faculty meetings away from the noise of NASA Hall. Upstairs were four bedrooms, one still containing a highboy with the initials AB inlaid in the top middle drawer. In the kitchen was a huge fireplace with a mantel over which a rifle could be hung, though even by the time of Esther, that was an anachronism. Outside the brick doorstep of the kitchen, she promptly planted a garden. The hospitality that Esther inherited from her mother made her a shining asset as a college president's wife. She wrote home about having 8 ministers for dinner on a Wednesday, 10 the next day, followed by a supper for 31 guests. Esther also had students living in her house as the college enrollment soon spilled over its one dormitory. Everyone in the Burr house was aroused at a dark hour before dawn when a horn blurted out in Nassau Hall next door, summoning students to chapel at the merciless hour of 5 a.m. The chapel, lighted by candles, was as cold as a ship's deck in winter. Under a life-size portrait of Governor Belcher, students sat to hear prayers led from the high pulpit morning and evening. They also returned to the same room to give declamations and read poetry aloud. The new college was soon clearly on its feet. Though he might now have relaxed and enjoyed some of the margin of his independent wealth, Burr continued working hard for the sake of his school. Edward Holyoake once remarked, "If any man wishes to be humbled or mortified, let him become president of Harvard College." Similarly, Burr was pushed to the last notch of his energies. As Esther once described it, "Company come and go continually. It is rap, rap. Is the president at home all this day?" In addition to serving as his own staff of deans, Burr also acted as college chaplain and superintendent of grounds. Fundraising continued to be a chore for him, though the college was off to a happy start. Burr had written to William Hogue about the very agreeable news about the Scotland collection, which has exceeded my expectations at least £300. He nevertheless continued to ply the British benefactors skillfully with such comments as, "We labor under difficulties at the present for want of books. We trust God in His providence will raise up benefactors." On another occasion, he wrote to the same friend, Mr. Doddridge, about a scheme he had for filling out the Princeton faculty with some British teachers. He sent the young son-in-law of the minister in the Presbyterian Church in New York City to scout about in England for them, and also added, "I am in hopes he will be able to do something for us by procuring some books or mathematical instruments, which are much needed." A happy facet of these fundraising efforts was the fact that Gilbert Tennant, who had alarmed Edwards during the awakening, had now settled into an Irenic ministry in Philadelphia and was proving to be an effective fundraiser for the college on the side. Another triumph for Esther was the mollifying of Robert Morris, who seemed to be mellowing toward the college. The students had a good time. A frequent entertainment was loitering at the tavern to watch the New York stage come flying in. They also organized hayrides to Trenton, and when there was a Dutch wedding in the neighborhood, students joined in the drinking and fiddling and dancing. Many of the all-male college students were as shy with girls as the Yale boys, who were, as William Livingston snorted, struck dumb at the sight of a spreading hoop or a lace waistcoat. But Esther's brother Timothy was used to girls. He had many sisters and a mother who was a social virtuoso, so he cooperated enthusiastically with Esther's matchmaking on his behalf. She had her eye on Rhoda Ogden of Elizabethtown, her father, owner of a substantial section of rich level soil, had been Burr's friend since the riots. Her brother was already showing the hearty talents that were to make him a senator and governor and a confidant of Washington. Rhoda was bright, vivacious, and kind, and when she was Esther's guest, Timothy was easily persuaded to drop in. The next year, Burr wrote ominously to George Whitfield, "The fatigue I have had in the care of the college this winter has been greater than ever being obliged to do the duty of a tutor as well as my own, one of them being taken off from duty by illness." In the sultry summer of 1757, Burr made a hasty trip to Stockbridge to give Esther and the children a visit with her family. On August 19, he whizzed back to plead with the legislature that college students be exempted from military service. Though he felt seedy, on August 21, he went to Newark to preach at the funeral of the tutor who had been ailing. Then he scurried back to a mountain of desk work, his bookkeeping listed David Hull, 3.404, tuition 18 shillings, for Elizabeth Crane's horse 14.33 for tutor. After making plans for commencement and the trustees' dinner, he dashed to Philadelphia on college errands. Next occurred the worst possible thing. Governor Belcher died. The college lost its most powerful supporter and Burr a treasured friend. He felt obliged to preach the funeral sermon, though by now he had an intermittent fever. He lashed himself all day to write the sermon and rode to Elizabethtown with a sizzling fever. When it was obvious to everyone that he ought to have been confined to a sick bed, he with great difficulty preached the sermon. The following day, he tottered into the cool, shaded entrance hall of the house in Princeton and collapsed. He died on September 24. Esther was pulverized. She wrote to one friend, "Your most kind letter of condolence set open afresh all the avenues of grief and again probed the deep wound death has given us. My loss, how shall I attempt to say how great my loss is? God only can know, and to him alone would I carry my complaint. Indeed, sir, I have lost all that ever I set my heart on in this world." Sarah and Edwards were crushed to lose a cherished friend, and they suffered deeply for their daughter. Gradually, the training they had given her supplied her with strength to meet the crises. On October 7, she was able to write to her mother, "God has seemed sensibly near in such a supporting and comfortable manner that I think I have never experienced the like. Thus, dear madam, I have given you some broken hints of the exercises of my mind. Oh, dear madam, I doubt not, but I have your and my honored father's prayers daily for me, but give me leave to entreat you, to request earnestly of the Lord that I may never faint under this his severe stroke. Oh, I am afraid I shall conduct myself so as to bring dishonor on the religion which I profess." Edwards wrote his daughter a reply typical of both his realism and the ways in which people found him exasperating in his clear-headed unsentimentality. "Don't be surprised, as though some strange thing had happened to you, if after this light clouds of darkness should return." He loved her so much that he did not want to encourage Esther to think she had yet survived the full ordeal. Though her parents longed to make this time easier for her, they realized that she still had grief work to do and that no one else could assume it for her. In time of extreme shock, one is carried along by reflexes. Crisis reveals what one has been trained to do by habit. So now the training Esther had received at home helped her to be busy about practical matters in a saving therapy. She set about organizing Burr's accounts and on November 17 wrote to their grocer, "I find by Mr. Burr's account book that all his accounts were balanced to March 29. Since that time, I find these particulars I now send you. I showed Mr. Baldwin your letter. I suppose he will soon send the cash for the coffee and sugar." Burr's will italicized the devotion he felt for all his wife's family. He left a 50-pound legacy for Elizabeth, the frail younger daughter. The settlement of his affairs also confirmed how generous a man he had been, for it turned out that many people owed him debts he had not pushed them to repay. His account books were sprinkled with such entries as a loan in 1756 to one student who found that the move from Newark to Princeton would be a financial hardship. Burr had advanced him money for the move, for bringing his chest and expenses in going to Princeton. It was typical of his character that one of Burr's last words had been to ask for an inexpensive funeral and to request that the saving be given to charity. Burr also left money for his two children to be handsomely supported and educated, but his death took away the one thing his small son needed most, the firm hand of a loving father. Burr had died on September 24, 2 days before commencement, the least convenient time for a college to lose a president. It caused a personal dislocation for young Timothy Edwards, who had been scheduled to graduate then, and his great day was clouded by the family's grief. The Princeton trustees scrambled about quickly to arrange for continuity of leadership. Obviously, Edwards was the man to hold the college together, but he was flabbergasted to be asked. He wrote back on October 19, the chief difficulties in the way of accepting this important and arduous office are two. First, my own defects, unfitting me for such an undertaking, many of which are generally known, besides others of which my own heart is conscious. I am also deficient in some parts of learning, particularly in algebra and the higher parts of mathematics and in the Greek classics. For many hours, Sarah and Edwards debated the invitation. Edwards had planned two ambitious study projects, a history of the work of redemption and a harmony of the Old and New Testaments. Should he stay in Serene Stockbridge, which suited his study habits so well, tugged by these projects, and aware of the many public appearances required of a college president, Edwards mused to Sarah, "I think I can write better than I can speak." On the other hand, Burr would have wanted this successor, and surely Esther needed to have her parents near. Finally, Edwards decided to accept and replied, "I think the greatness of the affair and the regard due so worthy and venerable a body requires my taking the matter into serious consideration." The trustees read this to be encouragement for them to send agents to Stockbridge, though it was in the midst of winter weather. These men put before a church council the case for Edwards' leaving. When the council decided it was Edwards' duty to go, he astounded everyone by bursting into tears, which was very unusual for him in the presence of others. Perhaps he was overcome by the realization that at last, after so many years of miscasting, he had come into a role he had always been meant to hold. Though her sister Lucy had gone to Princeton to stay with Esther, she could scarcely wait for her parents to get down. She was feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility of carrying on alone with the two tiny children. Little Aaron had a fever, and she had conniptions about that until she finally brought herself to a point of being able to say, "God showed me that the children were not my own, but His." Edwards, realizing the burden she carried, wrote her on November 20. "Dear daughter, I thank you for your most comfortable letter, but more especially I thank God that has granted you such things to write. How kind is your heavenly Father! How do the bowels of His tender love and compassion appear while He is correcting you by so great a shake of His head?" Then he went on to mention his concern about whether he could afford to furnish the house. He continued, "As to Lucy's homecoming, her mother will greatly need her, especially if we remove in the spring. But whether your circumstances don't much more loudly call for her continuance there must be left with you and her. Your mother is very willing to leave Lucy's coming away wholly to you and her. I am your most tender and affectionate father." Of course, Sarah decided that Esther needed Lucy more, so Lucy stayed on in Princeton. Sarah supported Edwards completely in his decision, and in this she spared the trustees the suspense they were to have later with Mrs. Witherspoon. That lady was a quiet homebody with many children, and she did not at all want to leave Scotland. Richard Stockton made an uncomfortable February trip to Scotland to try to persuade her, and one of his arguments with Mrs. Witherspoon was that Princeton was the cheapest place in America, a canny bait for a Scottish housewife. Benjamin Rush had to make another trip. Then followed a comedy of errors. By the time Witherspoon's wife was finally ready to move, the trustees had asked another man, Samuel Blair, to take the job. The exhausted trustees were stuck with two presidents. Fortunately, according to Stockton, Mr. Blair was so much disgusted that he certainly would not come in. Edwards told Esther he might not make it down to Princeton until spring, and she wrote back, "Perhaps I counted too much on the company and conversation of such a near and dear, affectionate father and guide." This melted Sarah, and she persuaded Edwards to start down and leave the moving for her to manage later. She had Titus, a Negro boy, valued at £30, to help her, and Suki was now old enough to be a delightful companion for her mother, so she convinced Edwards that Esther needed her father as soon as possible. He went down to be with her on February 16, 1758. His last Sunday in Stockbridge, Edwards preached on, "We have no continuing city, therefore let us seek one to come." And he read from Acts chapter 20. "Oh, how proper! What could he have done more?" exclaimed Suki. When he got out of doors after the service, he was deeply moved by the parting and impulsively turned about to say from a full heart to the people clustered at the door, "I commit you to God." Administrative work had heaped up since Burr's death, and Edwards settled down at Burr's death to tunnel through the accumulated papers. He also began to conduct what would now be called preceptorials, in which he gave out questions in theology to members of the senior class. They were to go off and dig out the answers on their own, then return to defend with Edwards the positions they had thought through. It was the kind of exercise Edwards had done with the young men who had trained with him for the ministry, and the students would have had an incomparable intellectual experience had Edwards been able to carry out the plan. However, he had been at his desk only a week when he decided to have an inoculation against a smallpox epidemic that had begun to sweep into the state. It was like Edwards to take a chance on something still in the experimental state and hotly debated. The city of Boston had been torn apart by the subject in 1721 when a great plague had been brought into Boston by a Negro who came in on a ship from the Caribbean. More than half the city's population caught the disease. Cotton Mather had heard about inoculation, which was being used in Turkey, and he begged the doctors to try the idea. Only Zabdiel Boylston took the suggestion. He tested the vaccine on his own small son and caused such a ruckus that he was mobbed in the street. Mather was angrily denounced, and a bomb was tossed at his house. When the epidemic was spent and tempers cooled enough for a rational evaluation of the controversy, it was seen that of those inoculated, the death rate was 1 in 40, while in others, the rate had been 1 in 6. Many people still remained unconvinced, though Thomas Prince was one who came to support inoculations. Edwards, always interested in science, had followed the subject. We remember that he had urged Burr 6 years before to be sure to get an inoculation before he went abroad. He reasoned that it would be good for the college if he set an example and had himself inoculated before the epidemic spread farther. President Holyoake had had to dismiss Harvard in May of 1752 because of an epidemic, and Edwards hoped to avoid a similar disruption. But his most compelling reason for doing this came out of the deepest part of his nature. He had written long before, "Old men have seldom any advantage of new discoveries, because these are beside a way of thinking they have been long used to. Resolve, therefore, if ever I live 2 years, that I will be impatient to hear the reasons of all pretended discoveries, and receive them, if rational, how long soever I have been used to another way of thinking." Meanwhile, back in Stockbridge, Sarah was cheerfully packing china teacups and storing woolen mittens as she bustled about her packing for the move. Parliament had, in 1752, changed the opening of the official calendar year to January 1 instead of March 1, which previously had been the first of the year in the colonies. One who has experienced a mud season in New England understands why it had seemed to the early settlers that a new year did not really start until the long locked up winter season lifted. As soon as there was a respite from soggy spring thaws, Sarah planned to start out and make two stops on a meander to Princeton. She hoped to look in on a sister-in-law at West Springfield, and then to check on her mother-in-law in East Windsor, where the older Timothy Edwards had just died at a great age. Though her children grumbled about leaving their beloved Berkshire Hills, Sarah was sure it would be good for all of them to begin a new life in New Jersey. Down in Princeton, new ribbons ominously appeared on doorknobs each day. That was the way people were warned to keep away from a house with smallpox in it. Watching the number of ribbons increase, Edwards decided to take the chance of inoculation. He wanted the best possible doctor to do it, so he persuaded Dr. William Shippen to come up from Philadelphia. Shippen was the first physician at the Pennsylvania Hospital. His brother Edward was a strong member of the Board of Trustees of the college. Both the Burrs and the Edwardses liked and trusted the Shiffen brothers. Edwards felt that if any man was qualified to handle the tricky new medical procedure, William Shiffen could. On March 22, 1758, as spring had begun to slip into some Princeton gardens and the cheerful yellow of forsythia flickered in a few hedges, Dr. Shippen sat down to write a difficult letter. It was to Sarah Edwards. Most dear and very worthy madam, I am heartily sorry for the occasion of my writing to you by this express, but I know you have been informed that I was brought here to inoculate your husband and your dear daughter Esther and her children for the smallpox, which was then spreading fast in Princeton, and that after the most deliberate and serious consultation with his nearest and most religious friends, he was accordingly inoculated, and although he had the smallpox favorably, yet having a number of them in the roof of his mouth and throat, he could not possibly swallow a sufficient quantity of drink to keep off a secondary fever, which has proved too strong for his feeble frame, and this afternoon, between 2 and 3 o'clock, it pleased God to let him sleep. And never did any mortal man more fully and clearly evidence the sincerity of all his professions by one continued universal calm, cheerful resignation, and patient submission to the divine will through every stage of his disease than he. Not so much as one discontented expression, nor the least appearance of murmuring through the whole. And never did any person expire with more perfect freedom from pain, not so much as one distorted hair, but in the most proper sense of the words, he fell asleep. Death had certainly lost its sting as to him. I conclude with my heart a prayer, dear madam, that you may be enabled to look to that God whose love and goodness you have experienced 1,000 times for direction and health under this most afflictive dispensation of providence and under every other difficulty you may meet with here in order to your being more perfectly fitted for the joys of heaven hereafter. I am, dear madam, your most sympathizing and affectionate friend and very humble servant, William Shippen. Sarah had asked herself whether she would ever be able to be resigned to the loss of Edwards or one of the children, and she had tried to be prepared for any testing life might require of her. Hopkins reports, Her conduct upon this occasion was such as to excite the admiration of her friends. She was sensible of the great loss, and at the same time showed that she was quiet and resigned, and had those invisible supports which enabled her to trust in God. But her body betrayed how she felt. No amount of valor can prevent the body from reacting in proportion to the actual feelings. So Sarah acquired a thrumming pain. However, she managed to write this to Esther on April 3. "My very dear child, what shall I say? A holy and good God has covered us with a dark cloud. Oh, that we may kiss the rod and lay our hands upon our mouths. The Lord has done it. He has made me adore his goodness, that we had him so long. But my God lives, and he has my heart. Oh, what a legacy my husband and your father has left us. We are given to God, and there I am and love to be. Your affectionate mother, Sarah Edwards." To the same sheet of paper, Esther's younger sister Susanna attached a scribble which explained, "My mother wrote this with a great deal of pain in her neck, which disabled her from writing any more. She thought you would be glad of these lines from her own hand. Oh, sister, how many calls have we, one upon the back of another? Oh, I beg your prayers that we who are young in this family may be awakened and excited to call more earnestly on God, that he would be our father and friend forever." Shock pounded upon shock. Dr. Shiffen thought Esther was safely over the disease, and for 2 weeks she appeared to be her usual incandescent self, though subdued by grief. Then on April 17, she had a sudden seizure and was gone. Lucy had walked into immense responsibilities when she had come down to Princeton to help her sister. Now she carried on, trying to console the Burr children. The inoculation had taken lightly on the babies. Little Sally had only 3 pox on her face, but their world had disintegrated. Lucy was helped by the same college treasurer whose wife Esther had once joked about. Esther, who was as kind as she was impetuous, would have been stricken with remorse for her jocularity if she had known that the person who straightened out the Burr affairs now was Jonathan Sargent. He ordered the rum and gloves for the funeral, paid doctor bills, sold Burr's wig, a small sheep, and a pair of turkeys, and arranged with Eli Hugh Parsons about the finances of the Burr children. He proved a good neighbor. Though she was dazed by her bereavements, Sarah decided she had to take over the care of Esther's children. By these monstrous circumstances, she had again been given the vocation to be a mother. Perhaps beautiful Stockbridge would prove a restorative place for these battered children. It had been for Sarah's own children. Lucy undoubtedly needed relief from the responsibilities she had been carrying, so an emotionally drained Sarah started to Princeton. In an effort to meet competition by a rival line, the stage wagons between Amboy and Trenton had spruced up, advertising that they were fitted up with benches and covered over so that passengers may sit easy and dry. But even with these refinements, the trip was a jouncy ordeal. To allow passengers in rear seats to scramble across to their places, none of the benches had backs. By the time she reached Princeton, thoroughly joggled, Sarah had concluded that the return would be easier by boat. The water route took longer, but in 1750, Robert Durham had introduced on the Delaware River a keel boat shaped like an Indian canoe, which might be easier traveling with 2 babies and lively 8-year-old Pinty. Edward Cowell, minister of the Presbyterian Church in Trenton, was the trustee who had stepped in to run the college in that interim. He was very kind. No one hurried Sarah in her melancholy inventory as she moved through her daughter's elegant house, sorting, dismantling, deciding what to carry to Stockbridge to give the Burr children a sense of continuity with their early years. What should she give away? What was to be stored until the small Burrs were ready to furnish homes of their own? The house held poignant associations at every turn. The perennials Esther had planted, curtains and towels she had stitched as the family sat together in the evening by the fireplace back in Stockbridge. Esther's dresses, even as they limply hung in closets, seemed to stir with her special style. Edwards's familiar handwriting leaped out at her from a desk drawer. The past rushed back, yet it was gone. The line of scripture that had served as magnetic north for the faith of Sarah Edwards was Romans 8:35. Who then can separate us from the love of Christ? The mighty confidence of Paul supported Sarah now. The love she had shared with Edwards had begun in the love of God, had been tinged with transcendence for 31 years, had now returned to its source. The rest of that passage goes on. For I am sure that nothing can separate us from his love, neither death nor life, nor angels nor principalities, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers nor height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."